Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
I am very happy to introduce today's guest, Catherine Tristan. Catherine, how are you?
I'm wonderful, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to have you. Now, Catherine, you are a research scientist on the faculty of the Washington University School of Medicine. You probably know that, but I think I'll let the audience know as well. You are a prolific author of both scientific and lay publications, and for many years, you yourself led a life, and I am quoting, that is described as riddled with worry and anxiety. But folks, I want you to note that I've just described what is often a debilitating experience, worry and anxiety, one that people suffer with, struggle with for years. But for today's guest, I've described it in the past tense. So how is that possible? Catherine Tristan, author of Why Worry, which is a great question. How is it possible that I can describe you as having experienced years riddled with worry and anxiety in the past tense?
I can tell you, actually, the one bullet that helped me kick this out of my life, and I'm going to shock you because it's simple, but I finally figured out that worry is a choice. It's simple solution, but it's not necessarily easy to affect in your life. So once I realized that I was really not the victim of my fears, which seems so overwhelming. I mean, I was ashamed of this. I was humiliated. I was in a very logical profession. I couldn't go many places that I was invited to all over the world because I couldn't leave what I thought was the safety of my hometown for really over 20 years.
Okay.
Finally, with a lot of soul searching, with a lot of tools that I developed, I found out that I was making a choice about this. And from there, it was a matter of rewiring some of the really bad circuits, rewiring my brain, essentially. Once I figured out what the problem was, then I started creating solutions.
All right, I got to stop you, and I got to ask this question. And I know you've been asked this before, but there are people who are listening right now who are saying, who on earth would choose to worry? What is she talking about? I worry all the time. I don't choose to worry. That feels terrible. What is she talking about? What are you talking about?
That's exactly right. And that's what I thought for many, many years. Like, I'm not choosing this. These worries, they just come and they're automatic. And what can I do about it?
You have no control over it?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And here's the thing. It's an automatic response, and so these things are wired in to us from childhood, from our life experiences, and we are responding out of an automatic way, as I said, your autopilot thinking and reacting. And so learning, though, that to hear what your mind is suggesting to you is really the key. It's becoming aware of how that inner chatterbox is constantly talking to you, like 10 people behind you all talking at once. You have to learn which voice to pay attention to.
Well, you know, that's really fascinating because you're saying that this is something that you've been taught since birth, pretty much.
Yes.
So how do you unlearn something that you've lived with for your whole life? How do you do that? Isn't this something you can kind of say, well, it's my parents' fault and I'm stuck? I mean, couldn't you say that if you wanted to?
Yes, you absolutely could, and a lot of us do that. You know, it was like, well, we can't do, you know, I am what I am, or I was born this way, or I've always done it this way. And it's like, yes, that's true, but you can't, I guess you would say you can't unlearn something if you've learned it, but what you do is you program over it. It's like a computer program. You can rewrite the program, and you can go back and then press, you know, enter, and now that is the new program. It doesn't happen quite as quickly as on a computer, but in many ways our minds are like that. Once we start reinforcing a different way of thinking, a more productive way of thinking, that's really doing some soul searching too, then we begin to respond out of that newer type of programming.
Well, let me ask you this. When you wrote this book, Why Worry? I mean, everybody experiences, I know every is a, you know, probably not the safest word to use, but I'm going to use it today just for this conversation. Everybody knows how to worry about something at some point in their lives. Everybody gets anxious about something at some point in their lives. Is there a difference, first of all, between worry and anxiety?
Yes, and I think what we think of more is that, and I understand this because I went the progression, and the worry is more of a thinking kind of process. Like I'm tossing this around in my mind, maybe, it's just always circulating around my mind. And when you get into the mode that you are constantly worrying, the next thing that can happen is that it takes you up a level. And especially if you have not created solutions and these things are constantly bombarding your thinking, then it becomes more physical. It becomes more body-oriented, where, you know, you've got the fast heartbeat, you might have shortness of breath, you just don't feel very well. You can actually make yourself sick. They say 5 minutes of really negative feelings, you can suppress your immune system for up to 6 hours. So you're progressing from your mind
Catherine,
to your body.
Catherine, I got to interrupt you because I know you're a scientist and you've just said something that is really kind of astounding. You've just said that 5 minutes of worrying yourself can suppress your immune system for 6 hours?
Right. Strong negative emotions will have an impact on your body, and the immune system is connected to your feeling system. And so when you have, you know, there's so many hormones that are circulating throughout your body, the brain body connection is very fine tuned. And so that is one of the sad things to know, is that you better watch out how you think, because it will affect your body.
It's going to affect how you physically feel as well as how you emotionally feel.
Exactly.
All right, so you can start off with worry, and you just kind of think yourself, it sounds like you're saying, into anxiety.
Yes, and you know what the next step is in some people, anxiety can then, if that starts to persist in your body as a pattern, which it did in me, this is why I understand this, is that once anxiety starts being your usual day, you're living life on edge, and that can lead, in the right setting, to panic attacks. Or maybe in other people, it leads to depression. It depends on your makeup and what you have inherited, how you're used to experiencing life. Mm-hmm. So for me, the progression didn't really go into depression, but it went into panic attacks. And once those guys hit you, that is a real strong wake-up call. And if you don't know what's going on, it's terribly frightening.
Well, describe the progression from, you've walked us from worry, where you're constantly worrying about something and then you start to get anxious about it. But again, talk us through the distinction, and is it a fine distinction between worry and anxiety? And then I want to hear about the path from anxiety to panic in a little bit more detail.
Right. So the path, at first, let's take a step back.
Okay.
And that is, you know, why do we worry at all? And is this normal or is this not normal? And what you find out is worry is part of a very natural process that's part of your psychological immune system. Just like we have a biological immune system that's built in and automatic and responds very quickly to infection. It mm-hmm. warns us, it protects us. Worries like that too. And so what we have is constant feedback in the mind that is feeding you with thoughts about this could be a problem, what about this? This mm-hmm. might be dangerous. You shouldn't do that, or would should you do that? You know, where it's a natural process, and what we have to do, it's almost like thoughts on a conveyor belt. We have to pick which ones we pay attention to, because worry was never meant to. Worry's a soldier, you know. Okay. It's trying to help us.
Okay.
And it was never meant to be the general. We're the general. Okay. We are supposed to pick the thoughts that help us. If we don't, and all those thoughts persist without resolution, that's the progression from normal ways to try to protect you, to have a better life, to work better, to perform better, to anxiety, because you're not creating solutions or you're paying attention to the wrong thoughts.
So worry in and of itself, not a bad thing. It can be very useful in and of itself in a context. But when it moves from worry to, take us down the conveyor belt, to anxiety.
So here's an example. you know, you are about to, say, have a presentation at work, and, you know, it just doesn't feel right. You're worried you're not going to do well. Well, the purpose of worrying in that instance is to help you polish it, to work mm-hmm. harder, till you feel comfortable with it. So it's feeding you messages to do better until almost you intuitively know, okay, I'm ready. This is good.
Okay.
And then worry will have done its job properly. Or maybe you're in sports, you want to do good in that swimming meet or whatever. It's like it's making you practice more and work harder. So in that setting, worry is a good thing, and it's fulfilling its natural requirement to try to help you along.
Okay.
Or even if you're walking down a dark street and suddenly you decide, you know, you don't feel good, you're worried about it, well, maybe you'll take a cab home and save yourself from being mugged or something worse.
Okay.
So worry is there to tell us about potentially harmful situations. Now, when it is not, and then we try to find solutions. It's supposed to guide us to find solutions.
Okay.
When worry is just circulating constantly, we're not trying to find solutions, or we feel we can't, then it can turn into anxiety because
gotcha.
It's unresolved.
Gotcha. Okay. So worry kind of helps you to move forward and look for kind of a fix it, whereas anxiety, you're just going in a loop and getting more and more worried and anxious.
Exactly. You're not.
Okay.
You're hearing the thoughts, but you're not able to create a solution in one way or another.
All right, not feeling empowered at all, feeling
exactly.
powerless. And now take us, we're still on this belt on anxiety. How do you get to the panic? First of all, describe what a panic attack is, if you would, and tell us how you get from anxiety to a full-fledged panic attack.
And anxiety is something that is there, and it can build, and a lot of times those of us who go into the panic mode are not paying attention to our feelings. You know, anxiety may come out as being crabby, unsettled, always feeling on edge,
okay.
and your sleep can be disturbed, you may be overeating or you're undereating. It's having a physical effect on you, and whether you pay attention to it or not is the question.
Okay.
If you don't see it as a red flag, then what it does is it goes to the next level, and you, out of the blue, you might have a panic attack. A lot of us who have panic attacks for the first time, like, wow, what was that? Where
right.
did that come from? I was just sitting here watching TV, or I was
mm-hmm.
driving, and then suddenly a panic attack, you know, burst forth. We never quite know where that first one comes, because a lot of times it's in a normal setting.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you this, once it happens, you are definitely paying attention now. But the problem is, now you're worried about it as opposed to what caused it and handling the stresses that caused it to erupt in the first place.
So let's talk about your first panic attack. What were some of the physical reactions that were going on for you?
So my very first one, you know, and this happens so often, that it's young people who, you know, I was in college and studying day and night for chemistry finals, and I, you know what, I just didn't get chemistry. I know I was supposed to, and I did study hard, but it just didn't resonate with me. You know, I liked biology, I liked so many other classes, but to get a degree in biology, you had to have the chemistry. So, and it was kind of cool back then to be smoking and drinking coffee. And, you know, before we really knew, we shouldn't be doing that as much.
Right.
And a lot of college students now still do the caffeine thing or
right.
the Red Bull thing. So I was studying day and night.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly as I'm studying these finals, I start to feel weird. And I don't know why, and I started paying attention to that weird feeling, and that made me feel even more anxious because now I felt weird. And then suddenly my heart started beating, and I felt like I might be going crazy. And that's one of the hallmarks, is that you suddenly feel outside of yourself, and you
yeah.
feel like, am I going crazy? And your heart starts beating, it's shortness of breath, and it's very intense, and it can be very unsettling if you don't know what it is. And a lot of young people in college and in other people, moms, even the elderly who've never had that, the panic attack has very physical, very frightening symptoms.
Okay. Very physical, very frightening, and you start focusing more on really what is a symptom, it becomes your life.
Absolutely.
And now you're in college studying to be a thinker. I mean, a scientist is somebody who thinks and values logic and natural progression of logical things.
Absolutely. This was so illogical. And, you know, and the thing is, you pay attention to it because it feels so awful.
Right.
And the next thing that would be happening is, you know, I would be driving and suddenly start feeling weird is what I felt. It just feels weird. And I thought, oh, I felt weird before. Is this going to happen again? And it would happen again. It would happen in different occasions and not really predictable. Because what's happening is once you agree with fear, it expands it. Once you agree that something is fearful or could be awful, that makes your mind pay attention to it, and it expands. So when you agree with fear like that, it expands. Instead of finding solutions, what caused this, what led to this, I'm focusing only on the fear now. And more importantly, what I learned as a coping mechanism mm-hmm. was avoidance.
All right, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to pick up, on the concept of agreeing with fear and where that then takes you and how to take it back. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will return very shortly. You said something that really kind of struck me. You said, once you agree with fear, again, that's a concept that I know for many people listening are saying, agree with fear? Who agrees with fear? So let's start there. Who agrees with fear? Why on earth would you do that?
You agree with it when you respond to it as something frightening. And what do I mean by that? This happens to actually a lot of people who really weren't in the deep woods of anxiety that I was. And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
You know, if you're in this anxious state and you have these fearful feelings that come up, say you're driving on the highway and suddenly you're getting stuck on the highway, that happens a lot. Well, suddenly the fear happens to come up, say, at that point. And now you're like associating driving with fear.
Uh-huh.
And you're agreeing that I feel terrible. I'm in this traffic jam, and I just want to get out, and I just can't get out, and this is a frightening thing, and maybe you progress into panic or very high anxiety. So what happens is that you've agreed this is a dangerous situation when actually it is not a dangerous situation.
I see.
Other people can do, you're at the what is another example? You're at the grocery store, even, and you're standing in line, and you really can't get out. You've got all these groceries, and you just finally, you trap yourself. You've agreed that this lightning-like fear is associated with being not being able to get away out of the grocery line.
Okay.
And suddenly it's like anything where you feel you can't escape now becomes frightening. And so you've expanded it because on a level beyond your conscious agreement,
okay,
you have associated this and you are now paying attention to it and it expands in your life. And now you don't want to do anything where you feel trapped, like even not go to the front pew of the church because
okay,
you'll feel trapped if you get nervous and want to leave. That's how it expands.
And this is an unconscious fear?
This is you're not aware of it. Yes, you're
okay,
not aware of it. What you are focusing on, because you aren't aware of it, and that's part of how you get out of it, is become aware of it and learn to disagree with those automatic thoughts. But because you aren't aware that you have a power, you become a victim to the fear.
So actually, the fear is not unconscious. That's very conscious. But the unconscious piece is your ability and decision to have agreed with the fear. That is the unconscious piece.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So let's go back to you and your path. You found yourself getting more and more caught up, more and more in agreement, if you will, with your own fears. Walk us through what happened.
Yes.
What happened with you?
So what happens is when, as I was saying, is when you agree with fear, it expands it. Because now I'm looking all the time as to, okay, I felt bad in the grocery store. I better be careful about getting in lines, just go in short lines. Or I'm afraid on a highway getting on traffic. Ooh, if I see a traffic jam coming up, let me get off the highway so I won't have these awful feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Then it expanded for me to feel in a number of situations, which were not scary, you know, going to like a baseball game and then everyone is leaving when it's over and I feel trapped. I can't escape because we're all in the crowd trying to leave.
Okay.
That happens to a lot of people in different settings. Eventually, it got to the point that in my mind, this is circulating and I was afraid to go anywhere where I might have a panic attack. And somehow my mind said, well, I will be relatively safe if I stay within about, quick distance from home where I could get back, about 45 minutes from home. And so for 20 years, I avoided any going anywhere that was more than 45 minutes from home. So it can really take over your life in a very negative way when you agree with it and don't realize you have a choice.
20 years, that's really extraordinary. And there are so many people who live that way and are still living that way.
Or have pieces of that. I have physicians at the university. We have this new interchange that is elevated. It goes over the highway and then comes back down.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a physician tell me she was in a line to do that. And for some reason, when she was elevated going over and high up, mm-hmm. she started getting a panic attack, an anxiety attack.
Mm-hmm.
And then with a long line of traffic, you're sitting there until you can get down onto the regular part of the highway. Well, now she avoids that interchange totally, and this is, I think, the rest. I don't know what's happening in the rest of her life, but this is an instance where now she is going to feel fearful if she has to take that or has to take a bridge, for instance. That's
uh-huh.
another big one for a lot of people.
Many people,
is
yeah.
that they're afraid of specific things and they avoid it if you can.
Now, what about a situation where someone actually has a traumatic incident? They're in a, heaven forbid, five-car pileup on a bridge. So now they've got, when they get anxious when they're on a bridge and they see traffic, but they've got a real live experience that they attach it to. Or someone who was assaulted or someone who has a relative who sustained some sort of trauma, and now they attach their memory or their beliefs about that real event to their own kind of fear web, if you will. What happens in that regard?
And it's the same kind of thing, because your mind can't distinguish, I think, one from the other. These are very real events that we are interpreting as terrible for us. And in one case, the reality agrees with that. You're attacked. You're on a pileup. You've been injured terribly, as opposed to being afraid of a traffic jam on the bridge. And so the process, I think, of healing is very similar. Is
okay.
What has happened is that we've wired our brains, we've wired our circuits into this frightening mode. And anytime, and that's part of again the natural process, because if something bad happens to you, your mind wants you to know about that, wants you to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And wants you to avoid anything that might bring that back. So this is a natural way to try to keep you from going out there anymore. So, but the process is one of rewiring. And in your field, you're probably dealing with trying to get people to take little risks into
uh-huh.
doing the things that frighten them. Once you have the mental tools
right.
to start rethinking and reliving your life, and that you realize that you do have choices in the matter, and that you can process this in different ways than the way your mind is feeding you. And then you take small steps. And it is a process of rewiring. None of this happens overnight.
Now, what does that mean?
We always want the bullet, the magic bullet, to make us be well tomorrow. But it really is a process of rewiring how you think.
We actually want that magic bullet to work yesterday before we needed it. But that aside, what does it actually mean to rewire your brain? You're not going to take it out and rewire it. So what does that mean? What are you talking about?
Well, the process is, what that refers to is focusing, how did it get wired the way it is now is the first question. It got wired that way because of the way that we're thinking, and it expands on that. And we've got like 100 billion neurons in our brain, and these things crosstalk with each other all of the time, and they form patterns and circuits and ways of reacting. And the way to get out of, and so they're essentially wired in a certain way.
Okay.
And the idea is to go back and start using some of the mental tools that I talk about in my book, and that is looking at ways that I can change how I'm thinking, I can change my attitude. And one of the most powerful ways of rewiring your brain is to take a step back and see how it's working in the first place. And a process that I call terribilizing.
Mm-hmm.
When something either bad happens, imaginary or real, you are in the process of watching out for anything that could be similar. And so
Right. You
might take a very simple situation of if you're afraid of traffic jams, is anything that the traffic, looking out for traffic and worrying about that, you terribleize. This could be terrible if I get stuck in that.
Mm-hmm.
And going over the bridge, that could be terrible. I'm going to feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so you terribleize and make something potentially catastrophic that is not potentially catastrophic. So that's what you have to rewire out of. And so my suggestion that I talk about in Why Worry is to start creating different statements, different ways of thinking, and I call that possibilizing. Isn't it possible to create other ways of thinking and focus on a positive outcome rather than a negative outcome? When you do that consistently, instead of focusing on your worry and what is potentially catastrophic, that is a process of how you begin looking at your life differently and your struggles and rewiring the possibilizing circuit.
So you're talking about changing your self-talk to something that actually is more affirming and more empowering and gives you more options and is actually more accurate.
Absolutely. And, most of what they... of course, aside from trauma, scientific studies show that 85% of what we worry about never happens.
Mm-hmm.
So when we are constantly on the worry mode, we are wiring our brains to have this self-perpetuating theme of worrying about something. But studies show that most of what we worry about never happens.
85%.
So when we kick into that mode, why not just evaluate that? And then also to create, as you were saying, self-affirming statements and more empowering statements, and what I call possibilizing, is that
Right. Focus
on a positive outcome rather than the negative outcome, because you got science on your side.
And
that's a good thing.
that's a very good thing. 85% of what we worry about never actually happens. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue and we'll really get into more of the nitty-gritty of how do you actually go about stopping yourself from actually harming yourself. This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk, and Catherine Tristan, the author of Why Worry? Stop Coping and Start Living, a hands-on workbook that's really going to help you change your life if you read it. Don't go away. We'll be right back. and we resume our conversation with Catherine Tristan, author of Why Worry? Stop Coping and Start Living. Now, Catherine, in your book, you talk about four concepts, that we always have choices, and we've kind of touched on that a tiny bit, and that it's really important to choose to change your own outlook, which, again, we've been touching on a bit. But I'd like to focus right now on your core concept three, risking helps me recover. Talk about that. I mean, just the way you phrased it, I'm sure there's somebody in there who may be approaching a panic attack right as we speak. Risking is not something that somebody who's in panic mode feels like is a good thing.
Well, you bet. In fact, I was an expert not risker.
Okay.
And the avoidance is what we use when as a coping mechanism when we have these anxieties and fears, and we become expert avoiders. You know, we make excuses. We can't do this. We can't do that. We just don't do this. We don't do that. So avoidance, not taking a risk. Very big response for those of us who worry or have anxiety. How do you get around that? Well, to get to the point of being able to take a healthy risk, and you have to learn to expand your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Where you do feel comfortable is something that you can't expand, but you don't really do that until you do change how you're looking at yourself and that you're not a victim. You have to make some fundamental changes before learning to take a risk that you feel you can handle anything that comes along. So you don't go from just having an anxiety or panic attack to start taking risks.
Okay, so it's not magic.
The gap that bridges those two is important, too.
Okay. It's not magic.
It's not magic, and it's not necessarily quick, depending on how long you've had the problem. But the thing is, it's a wonderful journey, and I've seen it from both sides, and I have learned so powerfully that when you can get to the point of changing how you think and changing how you react,
mm-hmm.
you will take that little risk. And when you take the little risk and you succeed, then it's so empowering. You will take the next step to get out of your comfort zone, because once you're out of your comfort zone, you can now step into the things that you feel more passionate about now. You know, pick up where you were happy before and
mm-hmm.
feel passionate and
mm-hmm.
What brings you joy in life, as opposed to what brings me safety, and sticking right there. So taking a risk is a process of taking little steps, but feeling that you can handle that, because, I mean, there are concrete ways to do it. You probably do that also in
mm-hmm.
your practice,
mm-hmm.
Specific things that you can do and how you can
right.
think. It takes steps.
It takes tiny steps. It takes building in successes. Let me ask you this. So many times when I've talked to people, especially around the beginning of having the experience of panic attacks, they'll talk about how angry they are with themselves, how guilty they feel with themselves. Because when they first have it, they're thinking, I'm dying, I'm having a heart attack. And then they go to the hospital, they go to the emergency room, they go to multiple doctors, and they're told, no, there's nothing physically wrong with you. And they start to have an enormous sense of shame and guilt, and what's the matter with me, what's wrong with me. Is there a way that you would like for people to think about that part of this whole experience as they're moving towards caring about themselves in a different way, such that they can begin to look at taking risks?
Well, you've really hit the nail on the head. And, you know, a lot of times we may be able to forgive somebody else, or we don't forgive ourselves.
Yeah,
you know, we feel we've
harsh.
Let ourselves
right.
down, we've let other people down. So what I discuss actually in a very long chapter in the book, because this is a very big problem, and that is, you rewire your brain, you cure yourself by especially focusing on three very negative emotions, and the blame, as you said,
mm-hmm.
and then anger, and then I also added guilt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, the blame, anger, guilt is a big old bag of junk, is the way I refer to it. And
sure
so
is.
We have to deal with each one of those. You blame yourself, you blame others, and I have sort of the antidote to each of those and how to rewire the negative circuit of blame. What I was discussing is the antidote to blame is gratitude. It's like, well, what are you talking about? Well, you know, instead of blaming a situation or why isn't this happening, why isn't that happening, that again focuses on what is what you can't do as opposed to what you can or what someone hasn't done and they should have. And again, blame is a healthy thing in the setting that it helps us assess what went wrong so that doesn't happen again. So the biological purpose of that is tries to be good. We take it overboard. So instead of focusing on what went wrong, focusing on what is right with your life, what is good about a situation, and when you can keep a gratitude journal. A lot of people know about that. Well,
yeah,
do
absolutely.
That, and then you tend to blame less when you see that there are positive outcomes. So blame is a really big thing to work on.
And it's an exhausting thing to work on. It never does anything but take you backwards.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so natural for us. I mean, it's not something that we're sitting there thinking, I think I'm going to blame them.
Right.
Like, no, it's our natural way that we've reacted for a lot of years. And if you want to get over yourself, you've got to change how you are thinking. And blame is another one. And anger, I mean, how many of us either fly off the handle or actually fly, you know, or implode inside, you know,
right.
bitter, cold, I mean, being cold in someone, and that's
right.
anger too. The different perspectives on anger, and so anger is another thing that you have to deal with, because if you don't deal with it, it's going to come out somehow, honey. Let me tell you,
well,
you've got to deal with anger. A lot of
true.
Us who have anxiety don't know how to communicate our feelings, and it implodes, or you're always angry with somebody. The best way, what I found, is to what I said was in the book, cultivate clarity. There are certain things that you can do. When you did this action, for instance, you can
mm-hmm.
use the when you, I felt. And there are certain skills to communicate your feelings better. When you communicate your feelings better, that you'd say to yourself, my feelings are important, and I
Absolutely.
Have to figure out how to convey them. So getting over anger is also a huge thing.
And so many times what we communicate, certainly to others, but also to ourselves, is that we communicate our thoughts and our negative thoughts about ourselves and others versus our feelings, which is typically very, very different from whatever the words are that we've wrapped around those thoughts that we have. And so it's really important to communicate your feelings to yourself, particularly as you go on this journey of rewiring your brain, I would suggest.
Well, that's absolutely right, Dr. Bruin. It's like your feelings are the drivers for so many things. Our feelings give us input, and a lot of us suppress our feelings or we don't know how to handle them. We've very likely never been taught very well. I don't think this is particularly taught in school.
No.
It's not. Your parents may not have known better to, you know, they may have not been taught either. So where
right,
are we?
Right.
We now have the responsibility of figuring out these things, and we have to, you know, the good thing is that once you do, maybe you can pass that on to your friends and your children, is that once you make that leap and learn to better express the feelings, that is a very good thing for the rest of your life and for others around you.
Let me ask you this. We're talking about something that typically in today's world, if you're diagnosed with anxiety, if you're diagnosed certainly with panic attacks and with depression, but definitely with anxiety, somebody is going to throw a pill at you. What is your thought about the combination or the use of medication, talk therapy, cognitive? There's so many different approaches that we use, but certainly medication is very often tops on the list, certainly for insurance companies. But for many illnesses, if you will, medication is perhaps indicated. So what are your thoughts about that? If you can talk yourself into a different way of feeling and experiencing yourself such that you've been able to, you know, fight back your worries and anxieties, do you need medication? Do you need therapy?
That's a great question, and that's a tricky question, because you know, there are some people who say, no, you should be able to do it without any medication. That those are terrible. They're all, you know, people do is the first thing they do is they reach for a pill. Partly that's true, but I am not anti-medication. I think that if you know how terrible the feelings are and how deep we can get into essentially messing up our brain biochemistry, sometimes those medications can help restore the brain chemistry. Sometimes they can help give us, you know, a interim where we can feel some normal to now do the interior work that we need to do. The problem is that we over-medicate and we take them and we think that is the fix.
Okay.
So, you know, and there are millions of us, and part of the problem, too, is that some of these things do not work and they cause more problems than they solve. And as you probably have talked about before, I mean, a third of antidepressants that are given for people with anxiety as well as depression, a third of them do not work, and it takes months of being on that to find out if it works or not. And the side effects can be, guess what, anxiety.
Right.
So...
Right.
You know, these are not without their problems taking them. So it's a fine line with learning to take them, but also to do the internal work that you need to do to restore your life to being empowered and being happy. And talk therapy, if you've got the right connection with the therapist, that is fabulous.
Okay.
Someone that helps you get your power back, that can be very helpful. But you got to find the right fit. Not everybody fits with your personality. So you have the responsibility for making some of these decisions, and you have to make them wisely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I say to people, if it's not a good fit, then, you know, then it's not a good fit, then it's not going to work. Somebody may be book smart, but if it's not a good fit, it doesn't particularly matter.
And I see that all the time. I mean, I work in a setting with, you know, physicians, psychiatrists, doctors. I mean, some of these guys and gals are very, very smart, and they know what they're doing, and they can, but they don't have the personal touch. Other people maybe know less of the science behind it, but they are exactly what you need. So you are absolutely right. You need to get the right fit that is right for you. And if you've got somebody who's well recommended, but you don't like them and you're not making progress, change that.
Exactly.
Find somebody else.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk, and Catherine Tristan, who is the author of Why Worry? Stop Coping and Start Living. And it really is a guide to helping you to turn your life around as she did hers and change it from perhaps chronic worry, anxiety, panic attacks to a life that is much more full and at the same time much more open and much more affirming. Would you say that those were some of the changes that you experienced in your life, Catherine?
Absolutely, and it's a wonderful journey, especially when you start taking those risks to get out of your comfort zone. When you've done the work and the mental and developed the mental tools, that's when you start taking the risk, and that's when things really start to take off, and that's when your life starts to kick back in, and you again can connect with inner joy, inner peace, and start doing things that you want. And you know, we put that on the back burner for a lot of our lives, depending
indeed.
On how much we're worried, we don't think about what makes me happy, actually. It's just like, how can I get through this day? That's the beauty of going through the journey from start to finish, is that once you start to rewire that and once you have new responses, your life is a lot happier.
Catherine, we're going to take a brief break, and when we return, I want to talk to you about stress busting and anxiety attacks in a bit more detail. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We shall return very shortly.
Thank you.
Catherine Tristan, author of Why Worry. I got to ask you this, Catherine. Somebody's in the middle of an attack. We've been talking about ways to rewire the brain, but that doesn't happen overnight. That doesn't happen in an instant. So let's say I'm on a bridge and I'm in the middle of having a panic attack. What do I do?
So what I found that helps me, and a lot of times when we're having that, we're like, what was I supposed to do? What was I supposed to say? What was I supposed to think?
Right.
And you're in the middle of it. And my sister had had problems with bridges in particularly, and she would be like, what am I supposed to think? I can't remember. Sometimes it helps just to write down where you want to go with it. But here's my suggestion.
Okay.
Is that a quick thing to remember during extreme anxiety or panic attack is what I call the stop, look, and listen method. All you have to remember is stop, look, and listen. So stop is just a way to immediately recognize that the thought is fear and recognize that you're having it and that you can say even very loudly to your mind, stop. You know, let's think something else. Thank you for trying to help me, but this is not right. I don't agree with this. So you stop, and then you immediately start responding to the physical aspects of anxiety, and that is shallow breathing, rapid heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So now, once you tell yourself in your mind to stop and start trying to take charge of how you're thinking and stop that train, that runaway train, now you try to do some deep breathing and just, you know, restore some of the oxygen and the carbon dioxide balance. Just deep breathe as much as you can or continue to take control of that.
And Catherine, what does deep breathing look like? Can you give us a sense of that?
Yes, no, that's great. It's like when you are shallow breathing, you're breathing from the upper part of your lungs. Your lungs go all the way down to the middle part of your chest. And so when you're shallow breathing, you're just breathing from the very top of the lungs, and it's shallow and it's short. So deep breathing is a way to go all the way down to the bottom of the lungs. At least, you know, as you start, you can actually progress down. If you can't do it initially, continue breathing 5-10 times. And that is also called belly breathing. And that's because the air goes all the way down to the bottom of your lungs. And guess what? When the air goes down to the bottom of your lungs, it stimulates something called your vagus nerve, and that is the system in your body that is that turns off the anxiety. It's the rest and restore kind of system. So you do two things for yourself. You not only feel better because you're breathing more correctly, it sends signals to yourself, hey, everything's okay, let's relax.
Interesting. Okay. So breathing, when we say breathe, take deep breaths, it's a different kind of breathing from what we typically do. Again, very shallow is what we typically do. This is very different. This is very intentional. It's very healing, and it's very soothing.
Absolutely. It's such a, you know, because anxiety is physical and mental, and you have to deal with both of them. So when you do the stop, look, and listen, you know, you're mentally dealing with yourself, and you're disagreeing with the fear. You're physically taking over and trying to get yourself in a more calm state, and that's the stop part. And then the look is to kind of focus on the present moment, not this terribleizing future that, oh, I'm going to feel awful now. It's to look around. It depends if you're driving, of course. You can't just look around, blah, blah, blah. You're
not good.
In an accident. But depending on where you are, I'd say get in tune with the present moment, where you are. Look around. Concentrate on other things, especially if you're not driving. Then, you know, look at the tree. Look it up. Look it down. Focus on tiny details that kind of link you back into the real world. And then once you're looking around, again, this is within just a couple of minutes you can do this process. And then finally, my suggestion with stop, look, and listen is now listen in on more productive talk. Listen in on more empowering talk. And this is where you get tools where you can pre-think and pre-prepare statements that, like, all is well, or this too shall pass. That was a favorite one of my mom's.
Okay.
And things that really strike a chord with you. So stop, look, and listen takes longer to explain than it does for you to kick into it. And that's something that you can practice even with lesser worries.
And, you know, it sounds like you're saying if you just write these things down and you kind of write them down on cards and leave them in your book, in your car, you're good.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we need to encourage ourselves. We're pretty good often at encouraging other people. Well, now is the time to focus on ourselves and encourage ourselves and become supportive of who we are and what we're trying to do. put those post-it notes on your mirror. Tell, you know, what are you trying to accomplish with things? And not just worry, but like, what do I want in my life? How do I want to think? Bombard your mind with that. And you don't have to explain that to anybody, by the way, if someone says something about it. But yes, have your cards and have a plan of action. My sister would carry, and actually mm-hmm. I would too, is I would mm-hmm. have water in the car, because I would just take a drink of water because you might get dry mouth.
Okay.
Anything you can do to feel more empowered, because now you're in charge, not the fear. That's what you want to do.
And I noticed that you have a list of 10 stress busters, and one of them, which is going to cause some people stress, is that you suggest that we embargo junk food. Now, that's a very healthy recommendation.
Okay, not forever. And,
forever wouldn't be a bad thing, but so many times when you're in that moment of extreme stress, you're going to look for the quickest thing you can, and you recommend turkey or chamomile tea or a banana, which are natural relaxants. So a banana is actually pretty easy, just to throw some bananas in your car.
You know, that's absolutely true. Bananas won't spoil, you know, for the most part. I mean, everything spoils. But you have, you know, have a drink in your car, have a banana, something to give you some type of natural relaxant, and also to keep your sugar level high. I mean, to keep it balanced.
Mm-hmm.
So what you don't want, and what we all often try to do, is, you know, we're feeling stressed or anxious, we're going to grab for that candy bar, we're going to, you know, get some potato chips, and so what you eat affects your mood. And I'm not going to stand here and say I don't grab for a piece of chocolate sometime, but I usually say, well, that's because I'm looking for the little sentiment inside that, you know, that's going to tell me something wise. But I think especially during times of great worry, great stress, mm-hmm. you really have to pay attention to what you're eating, and really try to eliminate the sugary food and highly caffeinated things. You know, those are things, especially caffeine, that can get you into a more anxious mode, and that is not what you want.
No, you don't need any help worrying yourself, quite frankly, or feeling
Absolutely.
Anxious on the inside. And you talk about smiling, and you say that studies show that even if you don't mean it, smiling releases mood-enhancing endorphins.
I mean, don't you just love science? I mean, you know, what a great study. Who did that? How did they get funding to
Who
do
thought
those
of,
studies?
That's a good
I
question.
I need to find that place.
We both do.
But it's true. You know, people who are looking at the endorphins and different neurochemicals have done these studies, and you can see that your emotions have an impact on your body, but just your body has an impact on your body.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, hey, let's just smile, but mean it. You know, you can't just like to turn your face up in a tight little fashion. And that's one of the things that you can do too. You know, when you're in the middle of keep perspective, keep balance. When you're in the middle of having some issues, try to smile. Try to think of something that's positive. Think of someone that you love. Boy, that can turn your neurochemicals right up on edge and restore the good ones, the happy ones. So, yeah, focus on the good endorphins.
So, again, I mean, the really good and happy news about all of this is that even if you have lived a lifetime of anxiety and worry, that you really can turn this around for yourself. And all worry is not bad worry. It's when it becomes anxiety-provoking, it becomes when it becomes excessive, and when it becomes a thing that gets in the way of your natural enjoyment of your life and your daily living activities, that's when you have to worry. But there's absolutely help. And quite frankly, reading Catherine Tristan's Why Worry, Stop Coping and Start Living, that's a place to get a piece of help. Catherine, you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to say, I had yes, absolutely. What's important is to have your mental tools, and one of the things that I think is really important too is when you're going to bed at night, go to bed in a peaceful frame of mind.
Mm.
And I have some tools on my website, whyworrybook.com.
Okay.
But what I'm suggesting is that don't go to bed thinking about what went wrong for the day or what you got to do for tomorrow. Go to bed in a peaceful way. And if you have a moment, I'll tell you how to do it.
I actually don't have a moment, but we can send people to your website, which is whyworrybook.com. And I will be putting your information up on the Mind Talk Facebook page as well. So we're going to make
Great.
Sure everybody can get in touch with you. Catherine Tristan, thank you so very much for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk.
Oh, I've really, really enjoyed it. I hope it helps a lot of people. And thank you so much for the work that you do.
My pleasure. Thank you. You take care.
You too.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.